Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. And on the left side of me, we've got Mr. David North Martino.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me out.
And on the right side, we've got the doctor, Mr. Eric Shapiro.
How's it going, Al?
Always good. But how could it be bad?
I can't imagine.
Can't imagine. I mean, here we are. Well, today, we'll just jump right into the interview here because we've got a great guest here. This is a man that's written over 100 books, and he has over 500 million books sold. That's just amazing. He's almost up to you, Dave.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, so Mr. Dean Koontz, thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So you've got another new book out called Quicksilver. How do you keep your ideas and your books fresh?
I think the biggest way you do that is to challenge yourself by doing something you haven't done before. Now, you can't always have, after all these books, be completely original. But it's amazing how many stories there are to be told, how many ways there are to tell them, how many techniques you haven't used before and that you want to challenge yourself to see if you can handle. And it's sort of an infinite smorgasbord of possible narratives. And that keeps me fresh. It's also good to have a publisher who can roll with what you're doing and doesn't expect you to produce the same book every time, which I've had sometimes in the past. Because I have to entertain myself first. And if I can't get myself involved in the story, the reader certainly isn't going to be there. So I think that's the way it stays fresh.
What do you find the most difficult part when you're writing a book?
Keeping the rest of life away from you so you can have long hours at the keyboard uninterrupted. It gets more and more difficult in this interconnected world we're in. I do best when I'm working in an 8 or 10 hour session. And that's when I fall away into the story and it becomes totally real to me. But it gets harder and harder in our world to get those 8 and 10 hour sessions. So that's the thing I struggle with most.
Are you able to just sit down then and kind of schedule and say, okay, well, this is on, you know, walk my dog, come back home, and then I've got 8 hours. I'll just write 8 hours and you can just turn it on and write? Or do you have to be in a certain mood?
Well, I get up at 5:30 by, at the latest 7 o'clock, I'm at the desk. I eat lunch, if I eat it at all, at the desk, and I work through to dinner. And I walk the dog in the morning, and then other people walk the dog later. And as long as you get into that schedule, you sit there. Some days are good, some days stink, and some days you produce next to nothing, some days you produce 5 pages, but it works out over time. It's that persistence of effort that I think makes a lot of difference. And yeah, you're not always in the mood, but if you just stay with it, the mood comes to you more often than not, and you fall away into the story, and then it starts to move.
You know, I've heard, Dean, over the years that you're very painstaking in terms of you'll move forward through a page, but you won't progress past it until it's just the way you want it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I do 10, 20, 30 drafts of the page before moving on. I always say that all writer's block has to do with the same thing. It's self-doubt. And I have as much or more self-doubt than any writer I've ever known. But the way I've never had writer's block is that I do this polish, polish, polish before I move forward again. Then I get to the next page and that self-doubt comes back. And I do the same thing. At the end of the chapter, then I print out pencil a few times. The beauty of this is it slows you down from that bad idea of a quick first draft. Because when you do a quick first draft, you kind of don't want to go back and do the work that makes it perfect. At least I don't. I'm at heart a potential slacker. So the way I keep myself from slacking off is that being meticulous about page-by-page construction and quality of the prose page-by-page. And it works for me. I don't say that it works for every writer, but I think it's the only way I've been able to produce as much as I have. By the time I get to the end of the book, it's had so many drafts, I don't need to go back.
So, in other words, having worked on each page in that manner 20 or 30 times, by the time you're at the end and you go back and read the whole thing, you feel it's locked at that point because you've been so meticulous.
You may occasionally get some thought later in the book. You have to go back and readdress something. But generally speaking, it's one of the great things about working that pace. Some writers say to me, and I've known a few other writers who work like this, but one thing about it that is so good is you're working on the story subconsciously while you're working on the quality of the prose and the narration and the characterization. And you see at some level problems coming. How am I going to get the character from here to there? How am I going to explain this when I don't myself know how to explain it right now? But your subconscious is working on it. And when you get to that moment where you've been anticipating trouble, you find you have 2 or 3 avenues to get around that problem. And I don't think that would happen if I wrote a quick draft.
So in other words, when you're doing this extent of revision, it's more of a, it's the way you're describing it is it sounds like it's cerebral. It's a mental and intellectual process, or at least a process that facilitates your subconscious as opposed to just a gut level emotional process of riffing it.
There's some of that. There's some of that gut level stuff. There are moments frequently where you come to something and you say to yourself, whoa, and you start to write it and you think, no, that's a very bad direction. I can remember I was working on a book called Life Expectancy, and it opens with 2 men in an expectant father's lounge in the hospital. And one of them is the father of who's going to be the lead of the novel, who is being born that night. And that character is moving from the expectant father's lounge to the critical care unit where his own father is dying of a stroke. And I knew that the other expectant father was going to be his nemesis for the rest, and the nemesis of his son being born that night. But I didn't know who it was. And suddenly, as I was writing the description of it, I wrote the word, he was a clown. And I stopped and thought, what? What do I mean he was a clown? And I meant that he was one of that Emmett Kelly clowns in a shabby dark suit with clown makeup, but not the big red shoes and all that. And I stopped and looked at that on the page and said, there's no way that makes any sense. But by that time, I've been writing so long, I knew that when the subconscious does that, pay attention, that's a gut level thing. And if I hadn't gone forward with that, that book, which has been one of my most popular, would never have been written because the character needed to be a clown. And so there is a gut level thing that I don't know is simply your subconscious working. It's intuitive at times.
Now, you started out writing under a lot of pseudonyms as well as your own name. You got to the point where you were, you know, earning a living, of course. Is there anything that you can pinpoint that, I guess, helped you to break out and become a best-selling author?
Well, we can say I was earning a living. It was touch and go a lot. And I was using the pen names because from the day I started, I liked to write different things. And my agents and publishers would say, wait a minute, you delivered this totally different sort of book. You need a different name to publish that kind of thing under. And I was young and stupid. They often go together. In my case, they went together in spades. And I took that advice. There's a lot of publishing wisdom that isn't wisdom. It's just common wisdom, which isn't the same thing. And I ended up at one point having published under eight or nine names. And the first bestseller I ever had was under a pen name. And when I finally became a bestseller under my own name, I said, enough of this. In fact, I'm going to go back to some of the best of those books and put them under my name. And they became bestsellers in paperback. So it was bad advice that I took in a misguided sort of way. And it was all based on the idea that readers always want writers to do the same thing. That's what publishers want. It isn't necessarily what readers want.
Now, I began reading your books around like 1987 at 16 with Watchers. And I have to say, you're partially responsible for my marriage because my wife and I, we bonded over your books and some other books that we had read. And that's how we ended up getting married. But just wondering, you know, with Watchers, there's an intelligent golden retriever. And, of course, Devoted also has a golden retriever in it. How important have dogs been in your novels and in your life?
When I wrote Watchers, I'd only had a dog, two dogs briefly as a child, and one lasted about 2 weeks when he wrapped a chain around my neck and he was tied up with a chain. You never should do that with a dog. And almost strangled me. I was 6 years old or five. My mother happened to look out a window and see it. So that was the end of Tiny. He weighed 120 pounds, so he shouldn't have been called Tiny in the first place. And I never had a dog as an adult, but I'd always admired golden retrievers. And the idea for Watchers came to me. I wrote it. And subsequent to that, I found that I love writing about dogs. I've included in quite a number of novels, different breeds, different, sometimes in a supporting role, sometimes in closer to a major role. And dogs have become very important in my life. I've had three beautiful golden retrievers now. One of them just had her head in my lap for a little bit while we were talking. And life is so much better with a dog. To people who've never had a dog, that sounds stupid or silly or sentimental, but in fact, it's real. You don't fully grasp the beauty of life until you've had a really good dog in.
Absolutely. Now, in that vein, you began your career writing standalone novels, and it's kind of what I came of age reading. And then you started writing series like Frankenstein and Odd Thomas later on. Why did you begin writing series? Was there a change in reader expectations, or were you just interested in following you know, specific characters through a series of books?
Well, I have to do cite two. I've written, I guess, four series. But these two, it's interesting. It was different things that sparked the series. In the Frankenstein series, I was put into business with a producer through our mutual agent, and he wanted me to update Dracula. I said, everybody has updated Dracula 100 times. nobody's updated Frankenstein. I kind of think that's more interesting. So I wrote a screenplay. We placed it with a network. They asked me to expand it into a two-hour pilot. In the meantime, that pilot, when I delivered it, fell into the hands of Martin Scorsese, who was looking for something to direct as his first fiction direction in television. He did documentaries before that. And Marty loved the script. He came aboard. I thought, wow, we've got an 800-pound gorilla, so this thing's going to get made properly. Well, it turns out nobody's really an 800-pound gorilla in that business. And they ended up just destroying the whole premise, making a very bad two-hour pilot out of it that had nothing to do with what I had written. And I thought, look, I'm going to have to show people what I really intended. I thought I would write three books in the Frankenstein series, but I wrote five. And the motivation there was really, okay, you idiots in Hollywood, this is what it could have been. And then the Odd Thomas, that idea came to me, and I found the writing of that book so satisfying. I was very high on it when I finished it. My publisher at that time hated it so intensely that he refused to talk to me about it. And we always talked endlessly about other books on Little Bird. And he would not talk to me about it. I knew through the editor that he felt this book would destroy my career. I felt quite the opposite. I pressed that we would publish this in the order I expected it to be published. When it got 100 and some lovely reviews, and only about one or two bad ones, and when orders from booksellers started to come in stronger than ever, he came to me and said, you said you wanted to write more about this character. Okay, I'll let you do it, but you have to give me another book in between each Odd Thomas novel. And that again was sort of saying, okay, I'm going to show you this works. People will like this character. I think his problem with it is the character wasn't a Clint Eastwood sort of character who can take care of business, or a Jack Beecher or that sort of character. He's a fry cook, and he's a guy who doesn't really much like guns, and he handles business in a different way. And there was a lot of humor and eccentric characters in it. It ended up being eight novels before I stopped. And so they came about in different ways. It was no real conscious intention initially that I was ever going to write series. Yet each one sort of happened for a different reason.
I notice quite often in your books you seem to write about standing up against darkness or an evil of some sort. Where does that come from?
It took me many years to actually think about it. And when I did think about it, I knew exactly where it started with me. It was with my father. My father was a violent alcoholic who held 44 jobs in 34 years. We never knew if we'd have a roof over our head from one day to the next. He, when things would go particularly bad for him, he would talk about killing himself. And more frequently, he would talk about it would be better if we all died together. I never knew if he was serious about that meant it or not. And so I grew up in that kind of environment. Later in life, I ended up supporting him for 14 years, moving in here to California, not in our house. I would never have that again. But I watched how my father lived his life, and I saw how unproductive that was, let's say. And later in life, he ended up on two different occasions in a psych ward. The first time he was identified simply as borderline schizophrenic with tendency to violence complicated by alcoholism. But the second time he was diagnosed as sociopathic, which explained a great deal to me. Sociopaths have no human feelings as we know them, but they're very good at faking them. And that was my father. He could get people to invest in inventions he made that were impossible to sell. And then he'd spend the money on drinks and women and gambling and never end up in jail because he could talk his way out of it. I think I began recognizing that evil was a real thing in the world then. And I certainly, as long as the older I get, the more I see it as an active force in the world. And not all evil that people do comes out of economic injustice or other reasons. Sometimes it's just plain evil.
Yeah, I had a very similar upbringing with my father as well. I found it was very dark, but I found that I was still happy. But I think I was in a different world. You know, my mind went in a different world. I ended up writing true crime and interviewing people in prisons that had murder and stuff. And I find that I sort of have the same idea as you. But my characters are real. Like, I go and meet them. Mm-hmm. Where do the characters come from for you?
It's somewhat of a mystery. A character like Odd Thomas will come to me. I was working on a novel called The Face, and I was halfway through it, and it was probably a 250,000 word novel, so it was a large undertaking. And I was halfway through and working in it, and my head came to mind, my name is Odd Thomas. I lead an unusual life. And I thought, what does that have to do with anything? And this happens to me from time to time. And I never write on him. I always write on the keyboard. But I keep a tablet beside me to make notes. And I made a note of that. That wasn't going to be the exact opening, but I knew there was something in a character named Dodd Thomas and that he led an unusual life. The next thing I knew, I was writing longhand, and I ended up writing the whole first chapter of that novel that day and the next, all longhand. And when I was finished with it, I kind of marveled at it and said, when I come back to this after finishing The Face, I'm going to think it's stupid, and I won't go forward with it. When I came back to it, that handwritten first chapter ended up being the first chapter of the novel. So sometimes I don't know where the character comes from, but if in the first 15, 20 pages, that character doesn't seem, if he doesn't speak to me or she, if I don't feel for them, then I know it's the wrong character and it's the wrong story. Fortunately, by the time I get 20 to 30 pages, it nearly always continues to work out.
You said earlier something about using your subconscious. So how do you become aware of your subconscious and help it in your writing?
I don't think you can help it. You know, there's this thing when you're writing called flow state, or athletes call it being in the zone. And when you're sitting there trying to get three or four pages out on the average day, that you feel are in an almost final form. And you're struggling with that. And then suddenly, once in a great while, you'll have a 15-page day, and you'll look at it at the end of the day and say, this can't be any good. I remember I had a 36-hour writing event when I was writing Watchers. It was going so well that I didn't want to stop. I wrote 36 hours and fell into bed and slept 12 or 14. And when I came back to those, all those pages I wrapped up in 36 hours, and read them, I expected disaster. What I found was I hadn't even made a typo. That is something you can't make happen. When you're in the zone or when you're in a flow state and you try to think about it, it goes away. It's mysterious. And I think always that's the way the subconscious works. It's working on all the material you've given it with your life. And if you just let it alone, it brings things to you that you weren't anticipating. It's not a satisfying answer, but it's the only one I can give.
So you've published over 105 novels, and then you have novellas and short story collections. You spoke a moment ago about how if the character's not clicking in those first 20 or 30 pages, you know it's not the right story. I'm curious if you abandon projects with any rate of frequency, and if so, how many unfinished novels are there?
There are not a lot of unfinished, because if it's not working, I abandon it pretty early. So I don't know, maybe 20 over the years. When I was starting out, I wrote three novels that never sold, as I fumbled my way to figure out how I did this or how anyone did this. But it seems like a lot of production, but Henry James wrote 130 some books. And I think it comes down to anybody doing this. It's a matter of how long you do it and how much time you put in and how much you really enjoy writing. I love people, but I love being in that room with that story. If the story is working, I have a good time with it. It's hard work, as you all know. Writing is hard work. There's no way around that. But if it's going well, it's also play at the same time. And if you're making a living at it, hey, who gets to have a job they love? It's sort of like play that you're doing well with, and you can work out of your own home. Back when nobody really did. So when you get to be my age and you've been doing this more than half a century, it's amazing how many books pile up.
I'm so curious about the element of loving people also, particularly in terms of what you shared about your dad. Have you always felt that you have loved people and been curious about people, or is that something you sort of grew into as you sort of countered your own upbringing?
I think I've always been there. I was a class clown in high school, somewhat of a slacker academically. But I always liked people. I had an aunt who was a very difficult person, lived near us. And I've actually thought of writing a book with this title, a memoir. I was not an unhappy kid. I could always find somewhere to go, something to be interested in that made me happy. Books were there very early. By the time I was 8 years old, I was writing a story. And when I got a bike and I could go anywhere in a small farm town and get away from that house, that made me happy. There were always things that made me happy. And this aunt of mine one day, this happened several times, she'd come upon me somewhere where I was laughing or I was reading a book and just in a great state of mind. And she'd scowl at me because she knew the situation of my family. And she would say, "You're too happy for your own good. You better wake up." And I always thought that was strange, too happy for your own good. I didn't know such a thing was possible. But I've sort of always been that way. You can either be defeated by what happens to you or just say, "I'm getting past this. This is not going to be my life." And for some reason, that was the way I felt from quite a young age.
So do you find, despite the fact that a lot of your work, it could be characterized as dark, you know,
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Suspenseful thrillers, and it has these mysterious elements. Do you find that joy is a big motivator for you in terms of the day-to-day work and the volume of work?
Absolutely. And also, these, not all my novels, Intensity, The Other Emily, some of them don't have a lot of room in them for humor. But Quicksilver is a comic novel in part. And I've written a lot of them have a high degree of humor in them. And sometimes that has caused problems, especially in the early years with publishers, when I was told you can't have humor in a suspense novel because nobody would be on the edge of their seat. And I said, listen, if you laugh with the character, he's more human, and you care more about him. And in fact, the way we deal with all the vicissitudes of life is humor. So everything becomes more real with that. But there was great resistance to it when I first was doing it. And if I was going to write a comic novel, it had to be a comic novel. It couldn't also be a suspense novel. And I found that was a very strange thing. I'm not sure if I remembered exactly your question, but I write a lot of dark now, but there, you know, the thing that readers say in mail, the most thing said most often, what they read these novels for, number one, before the suspense and the thrills, is the hope. And it struck me very profoundly when I started to get that kind of mail. And I had to stop and look at my own writing and say, you know, that is actually what's here, because that's what I believe about life. I am an optimist. I am a kind of almost drunken optimist. So it comes through in the books, and people seem to really relate to that.
Now, you're known to have an extensive vocabulary. Have you ever gotten pushback from a publisher or even readers for the vocabulary that you include in your stories?
You know, I've never had it from a reader. And there was a period of years where we got, when the snail mail was still the thing, we got about 20,000 snail mail letters a year from readers. And I never got one letter saying, your vocabulary bothers me, it's too big, I'm driven to the dictionary. But I did get it from some publishers. I remember when I was at Putnam before I became a bestseller there, my publisher told me, you'll never be a bestseller because for three reasons. One, your vocabulary is much too big, and you've got to cut it down. I remember she said 500 words, which I thought was strange. Your plots are too complicated and complex, and your themes are too complex. And I thought, well, it's what I do and here I am. I took it always to be what I found was often the case, not my current publisher, by the way, with whom I'm almost deliriously happy. But I found that it was something I encountered in very much New York publishing, a very low regard for the average reader. And that surprised me, because when I would get the mail and I'd look at these letters, I would get letters from readers as young as 11 or 12 that were a lot more articulate and interesting than I could have written when I was 11 or 12. And it showed me that there was a vast audience out there that was ready for it. Anything that challenged them more than most publishers seem to them.
Now, kind of in that vein, you wrote a book early in your career on writing. Would you consider writing another book with the knowledge that you have about the business today?
I took that book, actually, there were two of them. I took them out of print because I thought, what an idiot I was at that time. There's some good advice to him, but a lot of it is wrong. And the whole business has changed so dramatically that there's other things to approach. If I wrote a book about how to write, I don't even think I could do that anymore. I could write a book about how I write and how I love this language and what narrative fiction can do that fascinates me. You know, when I was starting out, I was young and I thought, You know, when I've learned all the tricks, which I don't know how many, I thought there were 48, 112, whatever, then writing these are going to get easier and easier. Well, what you eventually learn is there's an infinite number of tricks or narrative techniques, and there are an infinite number of potential stories. And so you're never going to learn all the tricks. The better way to go is say, what haven't I done? What could I learn to do better than I had on the next story? And that's sort of what I've done, how it's gone, and it worked.
Now, earlier you were talking about having novels turned into films. What's your experience been like in with Hollywood itself? And have you been able to give input into the films, or is it mostly hands-off, as it is with many authors?
I got involved in it. I wrote screenplays. They all got greenlighted. Only a couple of them never got made because once they're greenlighted, then you find the director. He often turns out to be a cokehead or something else, and everything falls apart for other reasons. I can remember I was on a talk show, a TV show, when Greg Kinnear had his own talk show, and he's a very nice guy. And I can't remember the movie that was coming out at that point. It wasn't based on my script. But he said to me, would you recommend people go see this movie? And because I'm always honest about these things, what came into my head to say was, Greg, if you had a choice of going to see this movie or nailing your hand to this table between us, nail your hand to the table, it will be more fun. And that's been more often than not my experience with Hollywood. I love Stephen Sommers, the director of Odd Thomas, but Stephen had a horrible time on that movie because he raised money independently. Then some of it disappeared. I'm not going to say what I think happened to it. Stephen had to put some of his own money into it, had to scramble with a crew sitting in New Mexico to raise the money to finish the picture. It never got to be what it could have been, but he was a gem, a jewel to work with. Martin Scorsese was lovely to work with and a generous and sweet person, but the whole project went off the rails. I have a number of projects placed now. I no longer want to write. I think the last thing I may have written, I might have done one thing later, was the screenplay for Phantoms. And I worked on that with Bob Weinstein. And that pretty much burnt me out on writing screenplays. I thought, stay with novels. You know that works. And you know you can control them. But right now, I have a very good film agent and very good book agents. I was without agents for 14 years because I got so burnt out on that process. But now I'm well represented, and we've got a number of projects placed for television with some really interesting people. So I've got my hopes up here, and I'm always ready to have them dashed. But I think in this case, maybe some of this will turn out okay.
Let's talk about the new book, Quicksilver. So what's the premise of this book?
Well, again, it's one of those things comes into your head. You don't know quite where it came from. In this case, I got this image in my head of a bassinet sitting in the middle lane of a three-lane desert highway, totally deserted highway. And in this bassinet is a three-day-old baby. When this came to me, I thought, well, obviously that's a novel, that's a story, but who is this? And then I thought, well, it's going to be that baby story, but you can't use a baby as a point of view. So you're going to have to go to the story when he's reached a certain age. And I knew in a few minutes he would be 19 and he would have been raised in an orphanage. And he's telling you this story afterward. And so I thought, okay, so what happens to him? And I thought, well, nobody wanted him. He was abandoned on the freeway, on this desert, lonely desert highway. What if nobody wanted him when he was in the orphanage? He couldn't get adopted no matter what the nuns tried to do. Present PowerPoint presentations of him, and nobody would adopt him. And then suddenly I thought, okay, then the interesting thing here will be he becomes 19, he leaves the orphanage, and within a year, every law enforcement agency in the country wants to get their hands on him. Now, why? And I thought about that for a while. And when I came up with the reason why, I laughed out loud and knew that it would be as much a comic novel as it would be a thriller. And that's sort of how it evolves. Sometimes they sort of evolve, and I don't work with outlines, so I never know all the story twists and turns, but I sort of need to know that much, something of that nature to get me going. And that's how that became. And it became a picaresque novel and road trip.
When you're putting together something like that, is there a subtext in your mind or something that you want people to get besides the story?
I knew that this story, you're sort of what the theme of the story are going to be. It always evolves into more than one theme, but I need one thing that this story is really going to be exploring. And I decided this one, and I've done, this theme interests me anyway, and that it's about a particular, I think it's the way where all the evil comes from in the world. It's the desire of some people to have power over others, whether it's political power, whether it's the power of a violent husband over a submissive wife. It's where the desire for absolute power leads to evil and destruction. And I knew that was going to be part of what this book was about. And it was going to be this character representing a force about undermining, destroying certain characters within the story. I didn't know that were perished characters who live for power over others. And so that became the underlying theme of the story. And then it develops others as it goes.
Do you find in today's climate of, political correctness and stuff like that, do you find that you have to be careful on how you write dialogue for characters?
I never want to write anything that offends anybody, but I never give it any thought. Because it's not what I set out to do. If somebody is going to read something the wrong way, there's no way I can prevent that. And if you dwell on that too much, you're going to rob the story of any originality that might have, because there's a lot of, there's people with genuine grievances, and then there's a lot of people with phony grievances, and you can't understand all of them. I've always felt I have political views, but the writers I admire, like Dickens, is a perfect example. Dickens is not a writer of politics. He's a writer about human travails. He's a writer about the evils of life, the things that can go wrong in society. But he never proposes political solutions to them. And I'm sort of the same way. I want to address those issues. But I think the moment you begin to layer politics into fiction, it's no longer art, it's propaganda. So it's best to stay away from all that and to stay away from thinking about how anybody's going to interpret anything. Just write about what's in your heart.
I'm so curious about the aspect of working without an outline. Does that allow you to surprise yourself a lot as you're going through the journey?
I used to write from outlines early on. It was once I was selling regularly, then publishers would pay me, set a contract based on an outline. So they get an outline, I get the contract, they pay me half the money up front, I write the novel, I deliver it. And they would say, well, this isn't that much like the outline. I would say, no, it turned out a lot better. But In their minds, they'd spent a year or a year and a half waiting for this, thinking it was going to be one thing. Even if it was 80% that one thing, they didn't like it because it wasn't the other 20%. And I became so frustrated with that that I finally decided with a novel titled Strangers, I was not going to use outlines anymore. I just start with the premise, a couple of characters I was interested in, and see where it would go. And it was an odd novel to start that way because it was like 250,000 words with a very large cast and multiple storylines. But it turned out to be the first hardcover bestseller I ever had. And it launched the career into new territory. And after that, I've never won that title again. And yeah, I am constantly surprised by where things go. But it's almost always to a good place. I say, I don't know how other writers figure to do this, but I always say I give my characters free will. I let them go any way they want. And if they go somewhere I don't think they should, I really seriously consider my opposition to it, because I've learned over the years that moment they take a detour usually is going to be more fruitful than what I had in mind. Now, some people say, well, you're creating them. They don't really have free will. They're not real people. It's the only way I can describe it, because when I stop trying to manage characters, the stories get much more interesting.
I'm also so interested in these pseudonyms from early in your career. I'm wondering, did each of them have their own personality, style, and sensibility, or what? Oftentimes, was it more convenience and just, you know, playing with different names? How did that work?
It was, some of them had Scottish names, because at that time you would see so many suspense writers like Alistair MacLean, Hammond Innes, they had Scottish names. So Brian Coffey, there were a couple more like that. I wrote under a female name.
Deanna Dwyer and Lee Nichols.
Yeah, Lee Nichols was the big one. Lee Nichols' first book sold over a million paperbacks. Somebody said to me, "How do you get into the head of Lee Nichols when you're writing this?" And I said, well, I put on a dress and a flowered hat, and then I go to bed. What was interesting to me about that was I had so many readers for those books before I had that many readers for my own, that when I issued those books later under my name, I got mail from women who had been fans of Lee Nichols and just could not believe a man could write a woman to that effectively. And that surprised me, because I said, well, I've known women writers who write men characters quite effectively. Why would you think men can't? And the answer would always be, because they don't. I think that has changed a lot. But there was a prejudice in publishers in those days. If a novel was aimed at women, it should be written by women. And I think that led to men not really being that interested in going in that direction in that time.
Okay, I'm going to, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to name some of your pseudonyms. And I want you to give a comment on what they're like. I'm going to start with Lee Nichols. What is she like as a writer?
She was all over the map, sort of like I am. She wrote one book that was pretty much a horror novel, but it was also police procedural. She wrote International Intrigue, she wrote a book called The Eyes of Darkness that had a virus escape from a lab in Wuhan. This was 40 years ago. So she was a little bit precognitive, I think.
What about K.R. Dwyer?
K.R. Dwyer wrote just a few suspense novels for Random House, and he was very minimalist stylist. Go for the throat, propel the novel, get it done in 200 pages and beyond the next.
David Axton.
One novel, David Axton wrote a novel called Prison of Ice, which I later put under my name under the title Icebound. He was a guy who wanted to be Alistair MacLean, because there was a point where I loved Alistair MacLean.
Deanna Dwyer.
That was very early on. I couldn't make a living at writing. I was writing science fiction and knew I was going to have to give that up, because it was what I read as an adolescent, but it wasn't where my talent was. And I had an editor who said, I can keep you afloat while you're trying to find your way if you'll write gothic romances under a pen name. And that was where Deanna Dwyer was born. So that was writing a gothic paperback novel in a month. And you would be paid in those days $3,000 or $4,000, which is much more than that now.
And the last one, the estimable Scottish writer, Brian Coffey.
Brian Coffey did some pretty interesting stuff. He wrote three books in a series, but that was his least work. Then he wrote a book called The Voice of the Night, which has been in print under my name for a long, long time now. And he wrote another book that I eventually put under my name because I had killed off Brian by that point. But he was adventuresome in a way that many of the other pen names I used at the time were.
Now, there's a concept in Quicksilver of the strange magnetism that draws the main character, Quicksilver, into the plot. Does that idea come from something in real life that you researched, or is it purely your imagination?
It actually is something I stole from myself. It's something that Bob Thomas has. He calls it psychic magnetism. And in the first novel, it leads to he's following psychic magnetism, and he doesn't know where it's leading him. And at the end of the novel, it leads him to this great tragedy. I was fascinated that in the Odd Thomas novels, and I thought I would use that a little bit again in Quinn Quicksilver, but it was just something that I invented for Odd and decided to use again.
Now, when you write Quinn or any of your other characters, do you have an inner monologue? Can you hear your characters' voices in your mind as you're writing?
Very often, yes. If I write with my office door open at the other house, this was true, and my wife's office was right next door to mine, and people were coming and going past the door, they would hear me sometimes laughing out loud and sometimes in tears, and it would be about the characters, and often when laughter was there, something the character was saying. I can hear how a character speaks. I know in the Jane Hawk novel, there's one of them, I think it's The Whispering Room, where she ends up in Arkansas. And I had what I thought was going to be a two-page scene with her in this rural crime boss. But I heard his voice and that accent and the patois so clearly that the scenes with him expanded. And it was because I heard him and I loved hearing him. I just wanted to write more from that voice and hear him talking and hear him interacting with her. And she was a voice that came to me. I never thought I'd write five books with her. I thought it was three, but I couldn't stop because I couldn't wait to see what she was doing next. And I loved particularly how she spoke. My editor said at one point, I love how she talks to the bad guys. And I said, so do I. She delights me when I listen to her talk. And if the character works, I can pretty much hear them.
Now, is that how you decide on point of view, whether it's going to be first or third person? Does it depend on how the character is talking to you or how you're kind of visualizing the story?
Yeah, to an extent. Odd Thomas just came to me in the first person. And it would have been easier to write the next seven books if I'd have been able to have multiple viewpoints. So you should occasionally, but then again, it wouldn't have been as good because his voice is what carries those books more than almost anything else. And so I like books with multiple viewpoints because it does let you shift around and change around, and give the reader different experiences. But every way you approach a story is interesting in its own right. It just is an intuitive thing. And well, if the story is one that's a big, sprawling story that's going to have storylines in different places, like Strangers or The Face or From the Corner of His Eye, or I have a book coming out later this year called The Big Dark Sky, those require multiple viewpoints. So it's sort of the material that drives it.
You know, when you mentioned Eyes of Darkness earlier, it's funny because there's a lot of stories around the internet about how you predicted the coronavirus, the Wuhan 400, years ago. How do you feel about something like that?
Well, I got rather startled by the fact it became such a big deal. And I was seeing all these things about how precognitive I was. And finally, I said in one interview that I hoped it would settle it. I said, look, the only reason it was Wuhan is there, in my research, I turned out this biological warfare laboratory, which is what it is. It's not just a biological laboratory. It has been for around 50 years a biological warfare lab. And that's what I needed in the story. So I said, this kind of came from this biological warfare lab in Wuhan. Now, the book does not predict a pandemic. It isn't about that kind of thing at all. But that's what a lot of people over the years are saying. So in an interview, hoping to put an end to this, I said that, look, I have no precognitive ability. I have no psychic ability. I have no idea what I'm having for dinner at night. And I hope that kind of approach should put an end to it. And it didn't. It just had to die out on its own.
Yeah, then they start blaming you for being in on it. You can't win that one, you know?
No.
Well, Dean, it's been wonderful. So your new book is available everywhere and, of course, on your website. And I believe that's deankuntz.com, correct?
Yes, deankuntz.com.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you here today, and we wish you the best. Thanks for being here, Dean Kuntz.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I had fun.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews. Get the latest news and opinions from Eric Shapiro from the House of Mystery website in the Shapiro Report.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.